Welcome Home, a podcast for veterans, about veterans, by veterans, is a project of Willing Warriors and the Warrior Retreat at Bull Run.
Good morning. I'm Larry Ziliox, Director of Culinary Services here at the Warrior Retreat at Bull Run. And this week, our guest is Sergeant Major Roy Lewis. He is a 36-year Army veteran who is a wonderful motivational speaker. He works with individuals and groups to help them get over some of the struggles that they face in life. And I really wanted to talk to him about, one, his career and experience. 36 years of doing anything to me is amazing, let alone being in the Army. And then just kind of talk a little bit about the struggles that our veterans face today and some of the strategies and things that he thinks can help not solve problems, but at least get our veterans in the right mindset to help them help themselves. So, Sergeant Major, welcome to the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Larry. Thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to be here. This is something that I'm passionate about, so you can call anytime.
So tell us about your career. When did you enlist? What was the trajectory like? What were the assignments? And I'm almost certain you were in Vietnam.
Well, close. Yeah, close. I was born in 1960, so I missed that campaign.
Ah.
However, I did 2 years of school, college, and kind of a point of trivia. I'm from New York. I'm from a town called Highland Falls. Nobody's never heard of it, but if there are any West Point graduates out there, they know where they've heard of Highland Falls. That's the town that's just outside the gate of West Point.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, my parents, my entire family, there was a mass migration in the 60s to Highland Falls, and all my aunts and uncles, everybody worked at West Point. So, of course, we were the generation that was born up there. So my impression of the Army, that was my first impression of the Army, really, believe it or not. And I didn't want to have anything to do with that, because I remember being about 8 years old and we went to go pick my dad up from work. And I remember this bus load of freshmen came in and they got off the bus and these upperclassmen came out of nowhere and they were just chewing these kids out. And I was like, oh my gosh, who would sign up for this? So that's how I ended up doing 2 years of school, college. And I was a music major, believe it or not.
Wow.
Just like most kids, I went to New York City and tried my attempt at fame, which failed. And it's so funny, though. My best friend, we're still best friends to this day. We've been best friends since kindergarten. I remember telling him, having a conversation in 1982. I was like saying, I'm thinking about checking out the Army. And we were at that time, and I think the Army still does it. They still have a buddy program where you can kind of go in with your buddy and you go through basic training together. However, my best friend, the day we got ready to, I was scheduled to go to Fort Dix, Jersey, and my best friend, he hosed me. He bailed out on me the night before.
He didn't want any part of that.
And boy, I would still remind him about that to this day. I was so upset. I thought I had signed my life away, Larry. I thought I was done. So I went to basic training in 1982 at Fort Dix, and my original job was logistics, was a supply, another fancy name for supply. I did 3 years active duty and was stationed at Fort Bliss. Did that. So I'm pretty fortunate. I've been in all three components. I've been in the active component, the National Guard component, and then I completed my retirement with the reserve component. So, So I've had the chance to see this full spectrum of duty. And I tell you, at the end of it all, you know, it's the greatest decision I ever made in my life to becoming a soldier. I've met so many wonderful people, had so many wonderful experiences, and it was great. And then moving on, when I got out in '86, I joined the National Guard. I went to move back. I moved to Boston for some crazy reason, but I was in three state units. I was in the Massachusetts Guard, then I went to the South Carolina Guard, and then I was in the North Carolina Guard. And then it just wasn't working for me for some reason, but I cannot remember this NCO. I cannot remember the guy's name, but he talked me into joining the drill sergeant program. So at age 40, I went to the U.S. Army Drill Sergeant School.
Wow.
And oh my gosh, that was so hard. I think that's my greatest achievement, Larry. It was, it gave me a chance to see what was basic training like behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I think out of all my careers, my jobs in the military, I loved it. Because I'm looking at it now. I still have my brown round in my office right now. And I loved it. Hard work.
Yeah.
Hard work.
Yeah.
But it was seeing those kids come off the bus, and they didn't know each other from Adam. And we had like 10 weeks to whip 60 individuals who didn't know each other. And at this time, the Army switched to its changed its policy. We were training male and female trainees together.
Oh, wow.
So that was difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was difficult. But we did it. Man, I tell you, if any drill sergeant doesn't tell you, doesn't make their, we don't cry. Our eyeballs sweat. Mm-hmm. So we don't cry. But seeing those kids walk across the parade field, oh my gosh, yeah. You know, they were so proud of themselves. And the fact that we had a part of that, man, was worth it. It was so priceless.
So talk about that.
And then
talk about being a drill sergeant for a minute. I don't think people understand how much work it is. So they just think and see the drill sergeant marching people around, yelling at troops. But behind the scenes, there's a lot of evaluation, a lot of coordination, a lot of talking amongst the drill sergeants about, okay, this guy needs more work. This guy's doing good.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just filling out paperwork. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, yeah. I gained a respect for it because I know if those that are vets, you know, when I was a private, I mean, the drill sergeants were like gods to me. You know, they were just, they never looked tired. They always look strong. They always look well put together.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I'm a drill sergeant now, so I'm looking at it from behind the scenes. And you're right. I never realized how much work went into a basic training cycle.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of respect there, especially when then people don't realize that when they raise their right hand, it's already been determined. You know, they put the companies together. Specifically, it's I think it still runs that way. A company is about 60 soldiers. So it's like 30 male, 30 female.
Hmm.
And also by their MOS, you know, so mm-hmm. they try to keep them together as close as much as together, like when they graduate basic. So if they're all medics, they're going, half the platoon is going to medic school
yeah.
together. So we try to do that. And then the day-to-day, I remember out in the courtyard, you know, we have a big chalkboard, and it has the schedules from 05 to all the way to 2100 lights out. You know, the whole day is just really engaged
yeah.
on training and stuff. But it's a lot, you're right. It's a lot of planning, you know, the training, the day is mapped at pretty much the 10 week cycle. The cycle's 10 weeks and it consists of three phases, red, white, and blue. My favorite was red because we call that shock and awe. I love that. You know, they get off the bus and it's on. I mean, I never knew we had so much power until one night we had picked up and I was on the third floor and one of my drill sergeant buddies said, "Hey, one of your soldiers is having a meltdown on the second floor." And Larry, I went downstairs to check on the soldier and this was the biggest guy I've ever seen in my life. He had 21 inch biceps.
Oh my god. Oh man.
I think it was like he was like that from that movie The Green Mile.
Oh,
he was
yeah.
huge. And he was bawling. He was just crying. And I thought he was faking. I just really thought he was faking because this guy had the capability to take the whole company out if yeah. he wanted to. But he was just a young man, 18 years old, and a lot of them, you know, are around 17, 18. That some of them is their first time away from home.
Oh, yeah.
So it is overwhelming. It is overwhelming. You know, I calmed him down and said, hey, you know, and I remember saying something like, you know, did your mother ever yell at you? And he's like, no, no. I said, did you, your dad ever yell at you? No, no. And I just yelled at him. I said, that's the problem. Now, get your gear and move out.
Yeah, really?
You know?
Wow.
So, but he ended up being a great soldier. But yeah, it's a lot of planning, you know, everything down to, I think if I had to say the hardest part is that middle phase, which is white phase. That's the qualification phase for weaponry and the physical fitness test.
Yeah.
You know, I tell a lot of soldiers, trainees, I say, hey, if we can get you do rifle marksmanship and passing the physical fitness test, everything else is easy cheesy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, and then the other part is just the dynamics of, I call it the best time management course in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, you go from sitting in your parents' house watching TV to when you wake up, when the lights come up, it's like, it's all like Donkey Kong. Each hour of the day is filled with
stuff. That's right.
Game on,
you know, everything is playing out. Yeah, for sure. Well, that gives them a taste of what the Army or the whatever branch you're in, that's what's going to happen.
My favorite part, Larry, is the relationships they form with each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part that's really interesting, because what we do is we put them in groups of two battle buddies.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't let them pick their own battle buddy. So we'll put the black guy with the white guy, or the Asian girl with the Spanish girl, on purpose.
Yeah.
And we tell them, you've got, like, you know, 5 days to learn if this person's married, if they got kids, where they're from. Oh, you're going to get it. And man, at first they can't. It's a wonderful experiment that just really works out so well. At first they can't stand each other,
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the 10 weeks, man, they're like crying over each other. They're just like, you know, you're my best friend in the whole world.
Oh yeah. Wow.
You know,
I'm sorry. You were a drill sergeant for how many years?
Well, I was in the reserve component, so we have the advantage of, as long as we're physically fit, we can be a drill sergeant as long as we want to, because it is a very high intensity environment.
Right.
So the full timers are only allowed to be a drill sergeant max 3 years.
Okay.
Only 3 years, because it really is. You know, I remember, you know, we go light, put them to bed at 9 o'clock, and then I'm up at 4. Mm. Lights on at 5. So.
Yeah,
and you know, at the end of the day, you know, we march them after chow. We bring them in back into the barracks. They got like 2 hours to write letters and get ready for the next day. And then 2100, 9 o'clock, the lights are out. It's a pretty intense, you know, environment. You know, then you're dealing with discipline problems and all that. But really, by the time you get to the third phase, which is the blue phase, and graduate like in 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
They're pretty much on cruise control. You know, all the kinks are worked out, and they're pretty much, they're acclimated to military life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So after I did the drill sergeant thing, my unit in 2007, we got the task we had the illustrious opportunity to go train the Iraqi army in 2007. So my unit, we got tasked to go to Baghdad. I was in Baghdad for a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, training the, and that was very interesting as well.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And a lot of people don't know, and I'm pretty sure it's the same thing for Afghanistan folks there, that their style of leadership is more of a Soviet Russian style of leadership, where the officers, they teach leadership from the top down.
Yeah.
For example, if you take out all their officers, the company is just totally lost.
Yeah.
You know, whereas Americans, we teach it from the bottom up. We always have leadership. If you're my commander, something happens to you, then I'm in charge. And then if something happens to me, the next guy's in charge. So there's always someone in charge.
The U.S. military has NCO Corps, which is solid.
Yeah.
And that's something the Soviets really
solid.
Don't have.
Yeah, I remember trying to explain that to my Russian Iraqi officer. He couldn't understand, you know, because we told him we had to set up a leadership academy. We're telling them exactly that about how to create NCOs to support him. But he was like, he just couldn't get his mind wrapped around it. You know, he was just like, you know, You know, and then when we did set up the Leadership Academy, the guys that we saw out in the field that shouldn't have been NCOs, they weren't there. They're very tribal. We saw like their nephews and their mm-hmm. cousins and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But that's why I think the American Armed Forces were the best trained in the world. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not a boast. I've had a chance to serve with other different countries and stuff, and it just works that way. And I'm real proud of it.
Yeah. You were deployed for a year there.
Yeah, I was in Baghdad for a year. I was on a special ops team, 11 guys. Go ahead, Dirty Team. Our code name was Dirty. We were the Dirty Team. and we went out every day, and me and my captain, everybody had a specialty. So me and my captain, our specialty was logistics. We had to teach them about how managing ammo, fuel, weapons, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And we did that for the whole year. And I got promoted over there. When you get promoted to E8, you're not allowed to be a drill sergeant. So anything after E7, you're going back to the NCO role.
Yeah.
So I got promoted over there to master sergeant. And then when I got home, I got to be a first sergeant for a drill sergeant company. So now I'm in charge of drill sergeants.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it, of course. It kind of made me sad because when they went out and did all the prep work for, you know, the comfort boot camp and stuff, I just had to manage it. I wasn't, you know, so I did that. And then did that for a couple of years at Fort Jackson. And then I got promoted again to where I finished up in 2019. I was at brigade level, promoted to sergeant major,
mm-hmm.
The S3 in planning. So that was, I have to admit though, anybody that tells you, even though sergeant major is a nice rank to get promoted to, because only 24% of enlisted soldiers ever make that rank.
Mm-hmm.
However, I was just used to being with the troops. You know, I was pushed back to the back office. So now I'm working alongside a colonel or either a 1-star or 2-star general.
Yeah. And that is mostly an administrative or a policy role, isn't it? That rank?
Yeah, that was it. It was kind of hard for me because I'm a hands-on guy. Mm-hmm. And I remember I would, you know, be at Fort Stewart and I walk in and I just start talking to the soldiers and stuff. And they would just like, you know, snap the parade rest. And I'm like, hey, relax, relax. I just want to know what you do and all that and shake hands. But I just love being around the troops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't lie. I'm not an office guy. I loved it. And, you know, and I have a son right now. He's on active duty. He was enlisted, but eventually he qualified. He's a warrant officer now. So he's over in Vicenza, Italy, as we speak.
Oh, that's a tough assignment. Yeah.
Yeah. He's military intelligence. And believe it or not, he was my problem child. He's my problem.
Well.
He said, you know, I said, so you don't think that's an oxymoron, military intelligence, all the problems you gave me?
Yeah.
So, but in 2009, I was given the wonderful honor to go down to Fort Rucker, Alabama, and pin his bars on.
Oh, wow.
It was nice. And I remember whispering, he was at the position of attention. I whispered in his ears and I said, okay, you outranked me military-wise, but genetically, I can still bring you downtown to Chinatown, sir.
Yeah.
So, and he goes, no, Dad, you don't have to say that. I said, no, no. I give respect where respect is due, because when you watch Forrest Gump, he says Lieutenant Dan through the entire movie.
That's right.
So,
yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
So,
yes. Yes.
Where were you?
W3 man.
Oh, is he flying or what? No, he's intelligence. Okay. Yeah.
Intelligence. Yeah.
Where were you on 9/11?
9/11, I was with my reserve unit. I think I was still in the reserves. And I was the first sergeant still serving with my drill sergeant company at Fort Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, when we saw the numbers, I did see the numbers of recruits, you know, bulk up during that time.
Yeah.
It was very interesting because we're used to seeing, you know, trainees that come in, recruits that come in around the age 17 or 18, you know, during that time, they were coming in at around 25, 30. I saw one person that was in their 40s.
Wow.
That came in.
Wow.
You know? Yeah.
People wanted to volunteer.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, everybody wanted to serve and stuff like that. And it was kind of unique. It made me proud, but, You know, there's a thing in the drill sergeant office, getting back to what you were saying about the responsibilities of a drill, and it kind of really left me an impression on me. We had it in the drill sergeant office on the wall. It says, let no soldier come back from the grave saying that they were improperly trained.
Mm-hmm.
We made sure that, you know, regardless of if you were a medic or if you were infantry or if you were a scout, we told everybody, hey, our job is to get you to survive on the modern day battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
This is our job, you know. So, you know, it's nothing personal, but we're here, you know, to make sure that you at least can survive on a modern battlefield. You don't come home. You come home with your family safe. You don't come home in a body bag.
Yeah. When did you retire?
I retired in 2019.
Okay. So not too long ago.
Yeah. I mean, that was surprising to me because that, you know, they had to kick me out because, I mean, I'm walking around. I'm older than the colonel.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, they're sitting there going like, wow, you know, because I would have stayed forever if they would let me.
And so when you transitioned, what did you find to be the biggest hurdle for you personally? What was it just the change, the lack of the tribe? What was it for you that I know there are a lot of veterans, especially soldiers who have been in for a very long time. It's very hard for them to transition out. It's the only life they've known. And
that's a great question. You know, I'm like my son right now. He's got 16 years in, so I'm kind of prepping him now for that situation. And here's why. I know when I got out, anyone that has served maybe a year to 20 years or 30 years, let it be known that the military culture, it's a secure community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go in there, you know what's expected of you. There are no surprises. We take care of our own. A lot of my friends that are not civilians, they say, you know, as you probably heard it 1,000 times yourself, that, you know, you vets, you guys look like, you know, you guys can come from different eras, but you talk to each other like you've known each other forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell people, well, one common thread that we all have is that we have that rite of passage. We've all gone through the same rite of passage.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's intuitive in all of us, that we respect in each and every one of us. So it doesn't matter. Whereas the world is like, so superficial. It's like people are given, you know, notoriety for the most silliest things, you know, superficial things.
Mm-hmm.
But in the military, regardless of what branch you served or whatever your job was, that when you wear that stripe, it doesn't matter if you're a commissioned officer or a non-commissioned officer or whatever, when you wear those stripes or you wear those bars, chances are you've earned those.
Sure.
To get those.
Yeah.
And you're taught respect from day one. That's one thing I noticed when I my first day in the Army, they told us, hey, if you have a beef with an officer or an NCO, they told us how to deal with it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember, Larry, one time when I remember just seeing an E7 and I was like, oh my gosh, that's a sergeant first class. Oh my gosh, you know, sitting there just being like, you know, starstruck. Just wondering, you know, when the first sergeant said hello to me, I'm like, oh my goodness, the first sergeant said hello to me. But, you know, we have that respect and it's always there, you know, and it's not compromised day one. You know, you don't look at the personality, you respect the rank.
Mm-hmm.
So that transition, I know I'm going about it the long way, but the transition from that environment into civilian environment is really kind of difficult at times because you're coming out of that safe haven. I call it a safe haven
mm-hmm.
environment where you're going in here now where people are like, I can give you an example. One thing that just drives me nuts. I go to the store or go somewhere and I'm standing in this long line. I'm like, why am I standing in this long line? If this was the military, this would never happen. When you have to get things done, civilians take their time. They get things done when they feel like it. It just drives me nuts.
Mm-hmm.
I retired. I was working for Bank of America for a while. And my boss used to always tease me all the time because he says, you're always the first one here in a meeting. I said, yeah, you know, when you have a meeting at 9 o'clock, I'm taught to be there at 8:45, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in a civilian world, they get there at 9:05, 9:07, you know.
Strolling.
I'm like, right, right. And I even told my son when he joined the Army, I said, hey, listen, you know, you're going to, hey, when he became an NCO, I told him, listen, I don't know, it's not in your vocabulary. Go figure it out, you know.
Work the problem.
And yeah, that's it. And I love our culture.
Yeah.
Because it demands you to produce, you know, and you know, I mean, yeah, we're not a perfect culture, you know. Yeah, there are people that can't hack it, but it's very minimal.
Yeah.
You know, when I see a man or a woman with those stripes and bars, man, and you can't, they've earned those things.
Mm-hmm.
They did the work to get those things. And you have to respect them for that. But in the civilian world, it's just so superficial. People are given notoriety for the most silliest things.
Yeah. Yep. It's all popularity,
yeah,
celebrity, all sorts of things like that. All absent,
yeah,
from,
I mean,
the military. All of it's absent,
yeah,
from,
exactly,
the military. You know, it's a strange new world. You know,
It is.
You don't
without it. When I got my drill sergeant hat, my wife had to tell me to take it off because I earned that baby. I burned that one with blood, sweat, and tears, man. That was the hardest thing I've ever earned in my life. When I got my combat action bag for service and during combat missions and stuff, I earned that thing. Nobody gave that to me.
Yeah.
So
they don't hand them out as door prizes. That's for,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let me ask you this. We see a lot of veterans that I often think that they've got to get out of their own head and they've got to find a way to motivate themselves to get going to either file claims for benefits or, you know, pick up the phone and call a buddy or go to a vet center and sit in on a group, do something, be, you know, get the help that you need. But it just goes into this downward spiral where the depression kicks in, the PTS, the TBI, too much medication, not enough medication. What do you say to veterans when it looks like they're just not motivated enough or they're just too much in their own head and they just can't get going?
Well, one of the things is it's almost like the survival of the fittest, you know, when a lion wants to attack its prey, it looks for the weakest animal. It tries to isolate the one that's isolated. And when they get that animal isolated, you know, they're able to kill it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the same thing in the military. When I go out, I may go to the movies or I may go to the store or the mall. And by chance, if I meet a vet, you know, and he or she will ask me, they say, oh, they're a vet. And that first thing I ask them, you know, where are you with your benefits? Where, you know, give me a synopsis of your career. What's going on?
Mm.
Believe it or not, I have heard vets say, oh, it's not a big deal. I just served 1 year or I served 2 years or I just did this, I'm really that. And I said, and I, you know, I don't have the authority of the U.S. Army, but I pull rank. I pull rank on them. And I tell them, I said, you go down and you are entitled to things because, that speaks to me in such a way because before I got out in 2019, I was just like a VA. I was like, you know, for some reason, my buddies were always talking about going into VA. And I always kind of saw the VA as a place where guys went there and got disability. And I had this pride like, oh, no, I don't need VA. I'm strong. I can handle my own problems and stuff like that until the same thing happened to me. I had one veteran that called me out on it, you know, made me go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized all my benefits, it just opened up a world for me, all my benefits, all the entitlements. And I'm able to, I filed for VA benefits the first time, and I only got like, I think maybe 35%.
Right, right.
And I was like, okay, it's not a big deal, whatever. But here's the funny thing. I went on a cruise with my wife and I ran into this guy and on a cruise with his wife and he's a former first sergeant. And he asked me the same thing, you know, you're a vet. I gave him a quick overview of my career and where I was. And he says, you didn't file your paperwork correctly. So long story short, he and I, after we got done with the cruise, he he told me to contact him. I contacted him. He resubmitted my paperwork, and I'm at 95% now. Oh. How does that happen? So it happens because we need to get, as veterans, we need to get back to talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And veterans are getting isolated. You know, they're getting, I've talked to vets that are homeless as well as professional.
Mm.
We got to get back to taking care of each other. And that's a responsibility. That's one of the things I love about being a veteran. We have to get back to taking care of each other. We got to start asking those questions. And because there are vets out there, yes, there are vets out there that are came home with PTSD, came home with, you know, issues, psychological issues. And we just, like, I believe in that model, leave no fallen comrade behind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that applies also in our civilian culture as well. We have to start taking care of each other
mm-hmm.
and watching out for each other. And that was one of the things I loved about being in the military, because my job as a first sergeant, especially when I was a first sergeant, when I had to learn leadership. And one of the things I learned about leadership was that that I had to take care of my soldiers. I had to know if they were there, if they're were taking care of their kids, if they were feeding their family, if they were getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
My job is at the end of the day, I think that was the hardest job of my entire career, was just being able to take care of soldiers and make sure that they were well supported in the families and stuff like that.
Sure.
And then I learned to like it, because I learned that's what leadership is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And I got guys promoted. I made sure guys got paid. I made sure guys had that there were, if they needed help with their families, if they were running financial issues, that's what it's all about. So I know I'm giving you a long answer, but the answer is we have to start developing concern for each other.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as a first sergeant, you really have to be ready for anything.
Oh, yeah.
Every
soldier is one-on-one as a first sergeant. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Every soldier is different, and they all have different problems. And, you know, one of the things I've always thought is when we look at the number of active duty suicides in the military,
mm-hmm.
Many of those have had disciplinary action, and they usually are within the first year of their service. And I mm-hmm. think part of the problem there is that for too long, the military just assumed that somebody would join and that they would put them through basic and that they would come out the other end, and every problem that they had in civilian life was gone because they were now in the military and they were molded into what the military wanted them to be. But I don't think that that's what happened. I think their problems still followed them well into their military career, because as you see, that soldier, as the years pile up, the likelihood of them taking their own life diminishes drastically. So I really think that we have to pay more attention to young soldiers, number one, on active duty, and especially those that get out after just a year or two. I always tell these young guys, I say, you know, if whatever you can think of, whatever you got hurt, whenever your knee got hurt or your elbow got hurt or you banged it against a tank or whatever, you need to go to the VA and file a claim, and you'll get a zero rating usually the first time. But by the time you're my age, they'll just look at you and say, oh, yeah, you're good. Here's 100%. Because that's all going to come back to haunt you as you get older. And now with the PAC Act, especially like yourself being that close at 95%, 100%, people don't realize 100% makes a big difference.
It does make a big difference. It does.
In states like Virginia, if you're at 100%, you don't pay any property tax.
Wow.
In other states, children go to college for free. So it really depends on where you live and get that rating. What do you think the number one issue is today that veterans face?
Well, I think you got to look at it from the veteran's perspective. You know, when you're in the military, you're taught to be strong. You're taught not to show any weakness, taught, you know, to, you know, suck it up, you know, so to speak. And I thought that way, you know, and then when injuries, you know, and the military is getting better at it now, but, you know, when I started moving up in rank, when I became, like I was an E7 and I was trying to make E8, Did I have injuries? Yeah, I had a bad knee. I was running on a bad knee and bad back, and but I couldn't like put it in my file because I would go up for promotion against other promotable E7s, and I didn't want that in my record, in my file, because I would be, you know, declassified. I wouldn't be in the running for promotion. So I know personally myself, I hit a lot of injuries and stuff.
Yeah.
And when I made E8, was trying to make E9, I had, again, a bad knee and a bad back and a lot of illnesses and a lot of things that was going on, but I would never, you know, disclose it, you know, for fear of not, you know, not trying to, you know, trying to get promoted.
Right.
So I think a lot of vets are dealing with it. We're kind of taught that. So now all of a sudden you're in the military, you hide those things. And then when you get released from the military, now you have to present those things. And I know from my experience, I had to go back. I know for VA, they're very sticklers about everything has to be service related.
Yeah.
So a lot of vets had to, you didn't have the documentation because you were always hiding it, you know? And
yeah, it never existed, you know, as far as they're concerned. Never existed.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So I had this wonderful guy that I, like I said, met on a cruise, and he showed me how to go through, and he did a wonderful job of me proving that I had these injuries,
yeah,
and stuff like that. So, and it was service related. So I tell a lot of the vets is that when you start getting, if you think you're going to get out, or even if you're calling in and you're getting out, if you're going to stay for a couple of years, you need to start keeping your own personal records of, because, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, you can jump off a tank or off a truck and, you know, tear up an ankle or ACL,
mm-hmm.
and you don't think it's a big deal. You need to start somehow documenting that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my son had knee surgery about 4 years ago, but it's in his records. I made him make sure that it's in his medical records that he had that injury, so it's taken care of when he gets out. And because he, you know, he was going through the same thing too. I want to be, you know, marketable for my next promotion. I don't want to put this in my record. I said, you need to log it in your medical records. It's you're okay if it's in your medical records. So should you need to, when you get ready to file for retirement or disability,
mm-hmm.
that's what they're looking, if it's service relatable.
You know, that. It's such a good tip there to document everything personally and have yeah. that kind of journal and record of your medical history that runs concurrent with the official Army or Air Force or whatever branch you're in with their records. The thing I would add to that is that if you were hurt and you hit it, you document the incident, mm-hmm. but also document who witnessed it, because the VA will take a statement from somebody you served with about an injury.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, because like 18 years later, you're going to go, oh, gosh, I fell off that tank and I can't remember who was there, you know, but it.
Yeah.
But if you could.
Yeah,
you,
no, like I did. I had to say it. Yep.
Yeah, if you had it written down, you could, oh, I got to reach out to so-and-so, and he'll remember. Yeah,
yeah, I had to track that stuff down. I was fortunate enough I was able to track down a lot of stuff to, related to my injuries and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But that, yeah, that's a great idea, is just to be able to keep records of that. Because a lot of that is also, you know, I think it's the same thing for all the branches. They, you know, soldiers and sailors and Marines and Coast Guard guys, airmen, they get evaluations every year. So a lot of times it's in their record that they, you know, what their physical condition is,
mm-hmm.
What is the current status of the physical condition. So it's not a bad marker in their record. So it is documented somewhere.
Yeah.
But if they keep it out of the official record, nobody would know.
Well, you know, listen, I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. It's just been fascinating. I really appreciate you you helping us out and talking about not only your career, but some of the motivational things that our veterans can do to try and get going and get the things they deserve. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Larry. I mean, I just want to say to the vets out there, do not minimize your service. If you are classified as a veteran, this is a funny story, but it's true. My father, my dad, I didn't even know. When I grew up, I didn't know my dad had served in the military. And he kept going to VA, and he was getting all this stuff. He lives in the state of Alabama. And he was getting all this support and all this medical support. And I asked my mother, I said, why is he going to VA? He's never been in the military. My mother said, well, he has. The thing is, he did 1 year in the Army, just 1 year. I think he did a year in the Army. And I said, just a year? And she said, yeah. So just imagine my dad having just served just 1 year, and he's got all that support. Just a single year.
Yeah.
So I'd say that to the vets, do not minimize your service. You know, talk if you don't know who to talk to, talk to a buddy that's going or someone that's going to the VA right now. You know, talk to someone that can point you in the right direction, or ask them to go with you. I've taken many vets. I've gone with them to the VA and been on the call or gone with them physically to VA to make sure that they're being processed correctly. So we need to start supporting each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarge. I really appreciate you joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me. Anytime.
Okay. For our listeners, we'll have another episode next Monday morning at 0500. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can reach us at podcast@willingwarriors.org. Until then, thanks for listening.
The Welcome Home Podcast is brought to you by Willing Warriors, a nonprofit organization serving active duty service members and veterans since 2012. To learn more, please visit our webpage at willingwarriors.org.